Okay. Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom from Central Florida. This is a special Sabbath. It's the Sabbath during the 10 days that cover this special beginning of the fall festival season. We have the first day of the seventh month, which is the Festival of Trumpets. We have the 10th day, which is the Day of Atonement. These are the Aseret Yemei Teshuvah, the 10 days of repentance. You could call them the 10 days of repentance and reconciliation. Time to make peace, time to make amends, time to patch things up, get settled, time to get your spiritual house in order so that you can really enjoy the 8 days later. And so it culminates in a fast so that we're, in effect, purged in the physical and spiritual sense, so that we're ready for the 8 days after that. So don't neglect the importance of that Day of Atonement. It's not just a kind of inconvenience thrown in there between the parties. It has a very important role to play. It's quite critically important. In fact, among Jews, it's even the atheists, that's the one day in America that they tend to close their business or whatever, be the Day of Atonement. I often talk about this, but back in the days of the silent movies, the first talking movie had to do with that very conflict between an assimilated Jew who wants to make a success in America but still wants to observe the Day of Atonement. And as you recall, in that case, the Day of Atonement won out. He did go ahead and stop on the Day of Atonement. Now, the other 364 days, he was, singing and carrying on and making a lot of money, but that one day, he stopped and went to synagogue, and the movie The Jazz Singer. So in some sense, that appreciation for the day, I think in the Church of God, sometimes the day has not had the importance it should have because of the fact that we tend to go away for the feast. So a lot of times we're in transit on our way somewhere, and then this day comes when we have to sort of stop and observe a fast. And it becomes a kind of just stop along the way, and that's unfortunate. It's a very, very critically important day. Each day is, of course, of the festival season. And this day is important. The weekly Sabbath is important because we need one day a week. Because, after 6 days, you need that one day. There was a secular Jewish, I think he was a psychologist, Eric Fromm, whose writings were very respected in the 60s. He was, of course, a socialist. But he believed in the Sabbath. His writings, as I said, were read quite a bit in the 60s, Eric Fromm, Frohm. But he understood the importance of having one day out of seven to rest and to reflect on moral issues. And this Sabbath is a very important one, as I said, because it is a Sabbath during a festival season, and it's the among Jews, it's called Shabbat Shuvah, the Sabbath of Repentance. Of course, during the festival days and on the Sabbath, we have the opportunity to not go to class, not go to work. There's a story about Mrs. Goldstein, or at least that's what I'll call her. She goes into her son's room and she says, "Bernie, it's time to wake up for school." So her son throws the cover, a blanket over his head and says, "Mom, I don't want to go to school. The teachers hate me and the students make fun of me." And she said, "You've got to go to school." So he says, "Why, Mom?" She says, "Because you're 52 years old and you're the principal." Anyway, now you're going to be hearing stories over the next year that you can blame on my son-in-law and daughter because they got me this book on Jewish humor. It's quite a good book, actually. So I'd like to go to 1 Corinthians. Here, Paul, who grew up in that tradition, made an interesting comment, which goes along with what I'm talking about. Don't think that because you've been around a long time that you're immune from slipping. And when you slip, you slip. You make a person could live a very wonderful life, but then do some really bad thing, and then he undoes the good. Because, if you've hurt a lot of people, if you've done a lot of damage, it's nice that you've had a lot of years when you've been good, but what about the damage you've done now? You don't want to ruin a good record with a horrible crime. In 1 Corinthians 9, Paul says, in verse 27, and he's comparing himself to an athlete. An athlete has to be disciplined. And, you know, when it's interesting. I have a feeling a lot of athletes, while they're in that profession, are very, very careful. And then once they retire, they probably their lifestyle changes a lot. I wouldn't be surprised if they figure like, well, all right, I've had my fling, I've won my gold medals. And I wouldn't be surprised if then they decide, well, I'm going to make up for all that I had to deprive myself of while I was on my way up. But here's what Paul says, and that's unfortunately we have to fight that tendency. We have to stick with it. I'm calling this talk "Committed Christian Commandment Keepers Continuing." You like the alliteration there? Committed Christian Commandment Keepers Continuing. We have to be continuing. This fall festival season should renew our commitment to continue. Committed Christian Commandment Keepers Continuing. We ought to be continuing on this road and not veer off of it. We're getting older now. We've been doing this a long time. But let it not get old in your mind. It should be renewed from year to year. You know, I keep learning new things all the time. I'm just astounded. That sounds vain. I don't mean I'm astounded I'm learning new things. Obviously, but I mean, it's just amazing. I could read the same verses over and over again. In a way, I'm astounded at my incompetence, because I'm thinking, well, why didn't you understand this 30 years ago? You've been reading the Bible long enough. Why didn't you understand this as a teenager when you were coming to synagogue and reading it? You know, why is it you had to wait till you're in your golden years, as it were, before you finally understand these things? And there's always more to understand. Verse 27 of 1 Corinthians 9, Paul says, "But I discipline my body and bring it into subjection, lest, when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified." Paul did not want to sort of throw away all that he had invested in spiritually by letting down finally, by kind of petering out later on. No, and neither do we. We want to, you know, press on, continue, maintain the standards we know, and just keep with it. And right now we're in an interesting period in the history of the Church of God, because these are in effect wilderness years. It's a time when the Church of God in effect is not well organized and powerful and focused, and seems to be scattered. And frankly, I do believe that we're going through a 40-year period, and I do believe it will come to an end, and I believe we're near the end of it. It occurs to me to look back at the example of the Israelites and to say, we don't want, especially near the end of this period, to right when we're finally near the finish line, to begin to make compromises and begin to get weak and throw off what we've been taught. No, this is a time to in effect remember these lessons and remember that there were reasons for what we did and didn't do. And we may need to refresh our memory. We may need to go back and study and remember, you know, why we do some of the things we do, why we don't do some of the things that we do. And before we discard what our practices have been, let's thoroughly review and understand. And maybe we'll find new meaning, a new reason to continue. You know, I hope that will be the case. So I want to focus today on examples of some of the greats. Leaders who themselves, unfortunately, didn't see it through to the end. As great as they were, they had such severe flaws that although the positive examples are there, we also have the negative ones. One of the great people I want to talk about is Miriam. Well, before I talk about Miriam, let me talk about the community as a whole in which Miriam was a leader. She was a prophetess. A prophetess in Israel. Well, let me just go ahead and, while we're turning, let's go to the book of Micah in the Minor Prophets. And in Micah, the sixth chapter, you see how important Miriam is. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt. I redeemed you from the house of bondage. I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. Now, can I mention any greater people than that? Now, they were all in the same family. They were all from the tribe of Levi, and they were all from the household of Amram and Yocheved, and these are their children, and Moses and Aaron. Aaron is older than Moses, and Miriam is, you know, the Moses' older sister who watched over him, and she is a prophetess, and Aaron, of course, was the father of the priests, He was the first high priest and the ancestor of the priests, including your speaker. He's my ancestor. In Europe, many of the priests took the name Kohen or priest, you know, so-and-so Kohen, you know, which means priest. But some took the European term Kaplan, which is a European translation of Kohen. So we have many Kohens in the Jewish community and also many Kaplans that are, and of course they're descendants of Aaron. So these three names are very great names. But you know all three of them stumbled in certain ways and had to bear responsibility for that, as great as those people were. So it's very interesting. It revolves around the wilderness experience. So I want to go back to that wilderness experience. The reason it happened is because the people, you know, were not responsive. And here they had seen so much. God had worked so much for them in their lives. But, you know, the attitude of the Israelites was always, "What have you done for me lately?" It's kind of incredible, but people are that way. You know, a great leader could do so many things, but then maybe towards the end he gets older and some things go wrong, and then they just turn on the leader, even though he did so much for them. It's like, as I said, "What have you done for me lately?" And in the book of Numbers, we see that the people who have been miraculously taken out of Egypt are now complaining, and miraculously sustained in the wilderness, are now complaining to Moses, we're not going to be able to conquer the land. We're going to lose out. These people are so warlike and so powerful, and they just want to throw in the towel, as they say in boxing, throw in the towel and give up. And so if you go to Numbers 14, God first thought of just wiping out the nation and starting over, and he didn't do it that way, but you know, he suggested that would be an option, you know, but he chose not to do that. And that shows how Moses was a type of Christ, interceding for the nation, praying, "Spare the nation," as Christ intercedes for us. Moses was a type of Christ. And you know how unpopular Christ was at times, and Moses was unpopular at times, and this was one of those times. But God said to the people, as you know in Numbers 14, you know, "You're going to now wander for 40 years. You're not going to be in the kingdom. You're not going to enter the promised land," which is, I know, as you know, a type of God's kingdom. We have our own promised land spiritually that we're looking to. In Numbers 14:34, "According to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days, for each day you shall bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection." So here they're in the second year of the Exodus. So they should have entered the promised land within around 2 years after they left Egypt. Let's say about 2.5 years later, they should have actually entered the land. Instead, they had to wait 40 years to enter. "I, the Eternal, have spoken this. I will surely do it. All this evil congregation who are gathered together against me in this wilderness, they shall be consumed, and there they shall die." Verse 38. But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh remained alive of the men who went to spy out the land. Those two. Remember the other week I was talking about how sometimes we have to go against the grain. We have to be a small minority. Well, here we had 2 spies against 10 spies, and the 2 spies were the ones that were right. And they survived, the 10 others were dealt with, executed. Or they died by a plague, I'm sorry. Well, I may as well read that since I'm here. Verse 36, "Now the men whom Moses sent to spy out the land, who returned and made all their congregation complain against him by bringing a bad report of the land, those very men who brought the evil report about the land died by the plague before the Eternal." So he supernaturally did away with them. What a witness to the congregation. And then, of course, Joshua and Caleb survived and went on to conquer the land. So this was the sentence. They were to live in that wilderness environment during that time. And they were not to enter the land themselves, but their children would enter the land. But you know what? Not all of their children entered the land, I believe, because some of their children were old enough to have participated in rebellions in the wilderness. And some of their children, even though they could have inherited the land, by just toughing it out, hanging in there, just being obedient for those 40 years, some of their children were not, and therefore did not inherit that promise. It's very sad that they couldn't, you know, just endure, you know, during that lifetime, during those 40 years, and then enter the land as adults and be able to enjoy their later years in the promised land. To get a perspective on this, I'd like to go to Jeremiah 35. What I try to do is vary with the verses that I use so that you get a feel for, you get a knowledge of the whole Bible. There's a lot of material in the Bible, and I want you to have a database, to use that sort of term, you know, so that you have the Bible in mind. So I want to go to Jeremiah 35. The word which came to Jeremiah, and I know, I'll get back to Miriam, but let's go to Jeremiah. Jeremiah was a priest. He lived in the territory of Benjamin, near Jerusalem. You might say suburban Jerusalem. The word from which, it would be today, the word which came to Jeremiah from the Eternal in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, the king of Judah, saying, go to the house of the Rechabites. So there was a man named Rechav, which could mean horseman, rider, you know, go to the house of the Rechabites, speak to them, and bring them to the house of the Eternal into one of the chambers, and give them wine to drink. Then I took Jaazaniah, the son of Jeremiah, the son of Habazaniah, his brothers and all his sons, and the whole house of the Rechabites. This is what the name of that clan was. They were named after an ancestor, Rechab. And I brought them into the house of the Eternal, into the chambers of the sons of Hanan, the son of Igdaliah, man of God, which was by the chamber of the princes, above the chamber of Maaseiah, the son of Shalom, the keeper of the door. Then I set before the sons of the house of the Rechabites bowls full of wine and cups, and I said to them, drink wine. So this was a witness. He went through all this to sort of test them. Drink wine. But they said, we will drink no wine. For Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, commanded us, saying, you shall drink no wine, you nor your sons forever. Now, I don't know why their grandfather evidently their grandfather was Rechab, and Jonadab was their father. So Rechab was their ancestor. Evidently their grandfather or their ancestor. And Jonadab was their immediate father. But they called their name Rechabites, but these were descendants of Jonadab directly. And he, Jonadab, said, you shall drink no wine, nor your sons forever. Well, you know, wine drinking is permissible and even encouraged, but in his case, he said to his children, don't do it. And they honored that request. He had his reasons, and perhaps they understood what they were, and they honored that request. And then further he told them, you shall not build a house, sow seed, plant a vineyard, nor have any of these. But all your days you shall dwell in tents, that you may live many days in the land where you are sojourners. Somehow he felt that living a normal life, living in the city, you know, where you have, or even in an agricultural community, with a permanent house and property, that was not for his people. They were to live as Bedouins. They were to live in tents. That's what he thought would be best for them, that they should, you know, be Bedouins, and to not drink alcohol. And of course, to this day, there are Bedouins who are not supposed to drink alcohol because they're Muslim by religion, and they live in tents. And it's interesting, in Israel today, there are pro-Israeli Bedouins. I was able to go to an area where they live when I was there. And if you ever go to Israel, if you go to the Negev region, there's a Bedouin museum, and there's a place to go to see the Bedouins and so on. And there are pro-Israeli Bedouins. And maybe some of them are descendants of these people. I remember I had a very strange experience one time. I was on a bus. I don't know why I was there, because it was a long time ago. It was 40 years ago. But I remember being on a bus going through the wilderness of Judea, I believe it was. And it was very barren country. I don't know why I was on that bus. I don't know where I was going. I may have been going to or from Jericho. I think it was the Jericho Road. That must have been why I was on that bus, I suppose. I was going to or from Jericho. And there was a woman, an Arab woman, and she was all dressed in black and all covered, you know, with a covering, covering over her head the way they do. Very modestly dressed, but it was in black, which is kind of interesting, because that's the summer in Israel. I would imagine wearing black could be kind of warm. But anyway, she was all covered in black, and the bus stops, and she gets off the bus, and I'm thinking, does she know even know where to get off and where to go? I looked around, I didn't see anything. Where is she going? You know, and I guess maybe a mile or a couple of miles down the road was probably a tent where she lived, and I didn't make it out. But evidently she knew right where to get off and where to go to get back to her tent. It was an amazing thing. So these were people, and their father said, "It's better for you to be Bedouins," and they honored that. And you know, the years went by, and they continued to live that way. And perhaps this has gone on for centuries. Thus, we have obeyed the voice of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, and all that he charged us, to drink no wine all our days. We one of the advantages they do have is they drink this really strong coffee, really good. But you have to drink it in small quantities, or you'll jump over to you'll be swinging from the chandelier. Anyway, thus we have obeyed the voice of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, and all that he charged us to drink no wine all our days, we, our wives, our sons, or our daughters, nor to build ourselves houses to dwell in, nor do we have vineyard, field, or seed. But we have dwelt in tents and have obeyed and done according to all that Jonadab, our father, commanded us. But it came to pass when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up into this land that we said, "Come, let us go to Jerusalem for fear of the army of the Chaldeans and for fear of the army of the Syrians." So we dwell at Jerusalem. All right, to save their lives, they moved into the city. You know, it was a temporary emergency. Then came the word of the Eternal to Jeremiah, saying, "Thus says the Eternal of hosts, the God of Israel, go and tell the men of Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, will you not receive instruction to obey my word, says the Eternal? The words of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, which he commanded his sons not to drink wine, are performed. For to this day they drink none, and obey their father's commandment. But although I have spoken to you, rising early and speaking, you did not obey me. I have also sent to you all my servants, the prophets, rising up early and sending them, saying, turn now, everyone, from his evil way, amend your doings, and do not go after other gods to serve them. Then you will dwell in the land which I have given you and your fathers. But you have not inclined your ear nor obeyed me. Surely the sons of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, have performed the commandment of their father, which he commanded them, but the people has not obeyed me. Therefore, thus says the Eternal God of hosts, the God of Israel, behold, I will bring on Judah and on all the inhabitants of Jerusalem all the doom that I have pronounced against them, because I have spoken to them, but they have not heard, and I have called to them, but they have not answered. And Jeremiah said to the house of the Rechabites, thus says the Eternal of hosts, the God of Israel, because you have obeyed the commandment of Jonadab your father, and kept all his precepts, and done according to all that he commanded you. Remember the fifth commandment, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long. Therefore, thus says the Eternal of hosts, the God of Israel, Jonadab the son of Rechab shall not lack a man to stand before me forever. So he said, that family will survive forever. That's why I'm thinking that the Bedouins we see today may go back there to that line, because there we see them, and God made that promise that this man would always have descendants. So for very possibly those are those Bedouins that are there. But it's amazing. God said they would so honor their parent that they followed his request, and you know, couldn't be pushed away from it, even by somebody like Jeremiah. You'd think Jeremiah would have prestige and they would do what he said. No, we promised our father we wouldn't do it. And so what about Israel? You know, didn't you promise me? And didn't I say I would bless you? And don't you have enough evidence of who I am? And yet you still are disobeying. And so you're going to suffer. But I'm going to bless this family for their respect for their parent. It's kind of it's a contrast. And that's what I'm talking about today. Keeping a commitment. Continuing to keep the commitment. Christian commandment keeper. Committed Christian commandment keepers continuing. All right, now let's go back to the account where I was. I was talking about how they were wandering in the desert for 40 years. And now we have the prophetess Miriam, a wonderful person, and yet, you know, she's got her problems. Let's go to Numbers, the 12th chapter. Now, there's a movie that I practically memorized. When I was a child, I saw it, and I oohed and I aahed. I was 10 years old, never dreaming someday I would own it. You know, what a world we live in now. It's just amazing. I remember when I first went to a Festival of Tabernacles, and I saw a Behind the Work movie about all the new technology that the church was using, and I saw the first example of a fax machine. I couldn't believe it. Wow. You know, you can actually Mrs. Michael put a co-worker letter in a machine in Pasadena, and it came out in Germany. Wow. You know, and it was like Star Trek. You know, all right, well, anyway, to get back to my point, this movie, The Ten Commandments, I could improve it, you know. One thing I could do, in the beginning of the movie, there's this beautiful young black princess who likes Moses. Now, at the end of the movie, Moses is about to die. He's supposed to be 120 years old. But here's Zipporah still there with him. Well, how old was she? Why is she still there? He's 120. How old is she? I mean, when they got married, she didn't look that much younger. The one that played him later on, she became, Mrs. Munster. But anyway, the one that played him, Ivan DiCarlo, what do you figure? He's supposed to be 40, which is wrong. Well, he's actually supposed to be 30 in the movie, so that's already wrong. But he's 30 in the movie, and what is she, about 20, let's say? And so at the end of the movie, he's 120, so she's 110? What's she still doing there alive? Everybody doesn't live that long. So she shouldn't even been there in the scene. That black princess should have been there. Because by the time he died, very likely that black princess was back there, and she might have been with him at the end, because she was a good bit younger than he was. So that would make the movie more interesting, I suppose. But anyway, let's go back to talk about that Ethiopian princess. Moses went down to Ethiopia and waged a war, according to Josephus, and a princess fell in love with him. And I suppose that princesses in those days would have married really young. So she probably was very young when she fell in love with him. She's probably under 20. And he would have been maybe not quite 40. So, let's say it was, he might have been about 38, she might have been about 18 when they married. And he married her, but then he went back to Egypt. Now, maybe the intention was eventually they would get back together again. But he very soon after that had to flee the country. So they remained separated all those years. In the meantime, of course, all these years go by. He marries Zipporah. And I suspect that Zipporah perhaps had a weak heart, maybe didn't live longer than she might have. She does come back and rejoin him when he's in the wilderness, but it may be that by the time you get to Numbers 12, perhaps she has died, perhaps at around the age of 60. Maybe she had a weak heart, as I suggested perhaps a moment ago, and she died at around the age of 60. So now Moses is about 81, and his wife perhaps has died, and now this Ethiopian princess comes back, and they finally get back together again after about 40, plus years. So what would that make her? Make her about 60, and he's about 80, right? And so that's, that makes sense. So she comes back, but Miriam and Aaron are upset about it. Then Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. So they said, "Has the Eternal indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" And the Eternal heard it. Now the man Moses was very humble, more than all men who were on the face of the earth. So he had no ego, unlike many of the rest of us. But he did have a temper, but not an ego. It's just interesting that you can have a temper and not an ego. He was very modest, although he did have a temper. So he wasn't worried about his prestige. But God wanted him to be respected. Suddenly the Eternal said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, "Come out, you three, to the tabernacle of meeting." So the three came out. Then the Eternal came down to the pillar of cloud and stood in the door of the tabernacle and called Aaron and Miriam, and they both went forward. Then he said, "Hear now my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Eternal, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. I speak with him face to face, even plainly, and not in dark sayings. And he sees the form of the Eternal. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Besides that, he's your brother." I'm adding that, So the anger of the Eternal was aroused against them, and he departed. And when the cloud departed from the tabernacle, suddenly Miriam became leprous as white as snow. She was evidently the instigator of this, the chief culprit in this. And Aaron, unfortunately, went along. That was one of Aaron's problems. He seemed sometimes under pressure to capitulate, and that's something he had to learn not to do. Then Aaron turned toward Miriam, and there she was, a leper. So Aaron said to Moses, "Oh, my Lord, please do not lay this sin on us, in which we have done foolishly and in which we have sinned." Well, he did quickly repent. At least Aaron, when he blew it, knew right away when he'd blown it. "Please do not let her be as one dead whose flesh is half consumed when he comes out of his mother's womb." Don't let her be like a child born dead. Let her be back with her capacity, with her not a body all rotting away. Verse 13, so Moses cried out to the Eternal, "Please heal her, O God, I pray." You see that? Was he worried about, you had it coming? No, he didn't feel that way. Then the Eternal said to Moses, "If her father had but spit in her face, would she not be shamed 7 days?" If she had really disgraced her family, it would take some time to live it down. So let her have some time to mull this one over and let the congregation have this warning. If her father had but spit in her face, would she not be shamed 7 days? Let her be shut out of the camp 7 days, and afterward she may be received again. So Miriam was shut out of the camp 7 days, and the people did not journey till Miriam was brought in again. So that was a certain warning to them, because they stayed around till she was back. And then you see in verse 16, then they moved on. So Miriam had her problems, unfortunately. And Aaron had his problems, too. And one example of Aaron's problem is in Exodus 32. He capitulated in the golden calf episode. Under pressure, he made the calf. Now, of course, he made this idol. Now, he knew it was wrong. He unfortunately went along with it. But as soon as Moses came back, again, he had the sense to know he was wrong, and not to say he was right and try to defend himself and try to overthrow Moses or some such perverted thing. He did, you know, yield and admit error. But at the same time, look at this discussion in Exodus 32. Talk about a study in human nature. Exodus 32:21. And Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you have brought so great a sin upon them?" So Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people, that they are set on evil. For they said to me, 'Make us gods that shall go before us.' As for this Moses, the man who brought us out, of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And I said to them, 'Whoever has any gold, let them break it off.' So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and this calf came out." You know, that's just a very poor way to put it. How awkward, you know. Anyway, but at least he admitted it was wrong. And then you see that the Levites all gathered to Moses to support him when he came back. In verse 25, "Now when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them to their shame among their enemies, then Moses stood in the entrance of the camp and said," you know, "Mi la Yahweh Eli," or as we would say in modern Hebrew, "Mi la Adonai Eli, whoever is on the eternal side, come to me." Which is, of course, what Mattathias said centuries later. You know, "Whoever is on the eternal side, come to me." And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together to him. All right, so they, you know, gathered together to serve Moses. That would, of course, includes his brother Aaron. But it's sad that Aaron did that. And here again, Aaron goes along with Miriam in Numbers 12. And so again, another problem. But, you know, God would have allowed him to enter the promised land, perhaps, even with those two mistakes. Moral failings, moral lapses, we'll call them, all right? There was a third time, though. You know, third time's a charm. With that third time, he did blow it, as Miriam evidently did. So let's now go to the book of Numbers. In Numbers 20, we find that Miriam dies. And she doesn't enter the promised land. Miriam the prophetess, the older sister of Moses, even though she was older than he, she could have outlived him if God had so chosen. But she died not having entered the promised land, as great a person as she was. "Then the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month. And the people stayed in Kadesh. And Miriam died there and was buried there." So we have that situation. Now, let's talk about the situation with Moses, and it'll also affect Aaron, because, as I said, there was a third time where Aaron, in football parlance, dropped the ball, you know, dropped the pass, you might say. And we'll get to that, or fumbled the ball, if you want to use that term. Let's go to back to Exodus 17. Well, I'll first go to Exodus 16. Rather. Did I say 16? I should say 15. Let's go to Exodus 15 after the crossing of the Red Sea. Now, here again, 10 plagues on Egypt, a miraculous escape. They come out with wealth, great wealth. They cross the Red Sea. The sea buries the Egyptian army. All these experiences. And then here we go again. You know, right away, they panic. In verse 22 of Exodus 15, "So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. Now when they came to Marah," which means bitter, "they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore the name of it was called Marah." Well, so far that's all very logical, right? All right. Well, you know, this explains the reason why it was called that and so on. "And it was too bitter for them to drink. They couldn't drink the water. Maybe I suppose there was something wrong with it. And the people, it's like this drink that we if you ever go to Epcot, there's this, what is the name of that drink? Beverly. I happen to like Beverly, though. A lot of people don't like Beverly. I love this stuff. Anyway, this stuff was much worse than Beverly. They couldn't drink it. Anyway, in verse 24, and the people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" Well, come on, give me a break. Couldn't they patiently go over to him and say, we need help, you know, let's pray, because God, of course, has done all these miracles. We need another one. I mean, we don't want to impose on him, but we're going to die of thirst if we don't want to do something. But that wasn't the attitude at all, was it? So he cried out to the Eternal, and the Eternal showed him a tree. When he cast it into the waters, the waters were made sweet. There he made a statute, an ordinance for them, and there he tested them. It was a test, but, you know, they didn't do that well. And said, if you diligently heed the voice of the Eternal your God and do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I put on the Egyptians. You know, if you think of Egypt versus Israel, even today, if you were to go to Israel today, it's like a modern Western nation, and the standards are similar. And I imagine if you went to Egypt, you'd find a lot of diseases which would be considered exotic, fortunately, in America. Because Egypt is still, in many ways, a third world country. I would imagine, especially as you get into more rural areas. It's not a put down on the nation. It's just, you know, the way it is. A lot of the nations in the world are developing nations, as we call them. And they have a lot of diseases that have been stamped out in the industrialized world. And so God tells them, you know, you're going to be, in effect, a first world nation, not a third world nation, when it comes to disease, if you obey me. I will put none of the diseases on you which I put on the Egyptians, for I am the Eternal who heals you. I am Adonai Rofecha, or in ancient times it would have been Yahweh Rofecha, you know, the Eternal, your healer. And so he told them that if you obey, you'll be blessed. But if you disobey, of course, that's, you know, the other side of the coin. Then you'll have to have the consequences. All right, now if we pursue the matter further. This place was called Massa, wasn't it? Because he tested them there, you know. So the place was called Massa. Now there's another place later on, which is called, you know, Massa and Meriva. You know, I think as we go further into the account, there's another account where. Where Moses changes water, takes a rock and gives them water. Okay, so let's go to Numbers. I'm in Numbers 20. I want to go back to the to an earlier account in Numbers. Let me go to Psalm 95. In Psalm 95, God speaks to the Israelites about times that He has tested them, or that they, in a way, have tested Him, and they've, you know, rebelled against Him. And He refers to these times where they've complained about lack of water. You know, in Psalm 95. Here I'm going to ask my computer people to come in, because what I want is, there's this account of Numbers 20. There's an earlier one where Moses takes a rod to a rock and gives them water. There's an earlier account that I want to turn to first. It could be in Exodus. It's where Moses takes a rod and hits the rock and water comes out. And I want to turn to that one before I go to this one in Numbers 20, because Numbers 20 was a different case. But I want to go to the second case, which is. Okay, I believe that's where it is, yeah. Let's go to Exodus 17. I'm sorry that I took too much time finding it. There were two cases right close together, 16 and 17, so I got a little disoriented there because they're so close together. It is incredible when you think about it, how the Israelites had one problem after another, and but yet that is human nature, and people do tend to act that way. And if any of you have dealt with groups of people, I think you'll find that, you know, that things can be going well, and then as soon as there's a problem, they seem to forget all that you did for them before, and right away, they, you know, what are you going to do now? Well, give me some time. Haven't I done okay so far? But that's not the way people tend to operate. So anyway, here we are in Exodus 17. And in this case, once again, it's hard to believe it happened that fast, but it did. Verse 17, then all the congregation of the children of Israel set out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin according to the commandment of the Eternal and camped in Rephidim, but there was no water for the people to drink. Yes, that's the case I was looking for. Therefore, the people contended with Moses and said, give us water that we may drink. So Moses said to them, why do you contend with me? Why do you tempt the Eternal? And the people thirsted there for water. And the people complained against Moses and said, why is it you have brought us up out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst? What a thing to say to this man. What about what all this man had been through and all that they had been through with him and all that God had done for them? What a thing to say. So Moses cried out to the Eternal saying, what shall I do with this people? They're almost ready to stone me. They wanted almost to kill him. Remember that in case of Jesus Christ, that was what happened. The crowd turned on him, and they told the Romans, crucify him. And the Eternal said to Moses, go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river, and go. So that would be a sign to them. Hey, remember all that happened before? Behold, I will... And also it's a sign of his authority that they were disrespecting. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock in Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and the water will come out. Water will come out of it, and the people may drink. See, they're on their way to make the covenant. They're on their way to receive the Ten Commandments. And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. So he all called the name of the place Massa and Meribah. Massa meaning test, and Meribah meaning strife. So, in the first case, we have this place called Marah. Not Massa, but Marah, because of the bitterness of the waters originally. And now we have the place called Massa, but it's called Massa and Meribah. You know, test and strife. So the first place is Marah, bitterness. The next place is called, and he made the water sweet. He miraculously made the water sweet so they could be drunk, and then or drunken. And then the next case was a place called Massa and Meribah. Massa and Meribah. Testing and strife, because of the contention of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Eternal, saying, is the Eternal among us or not? So they got really skeptical and cynical and immediately reacted to this problem impatiently and disrespectfully and rebelliously. It's very sad. And that's why in Psalm 95, I didn't read much of Psalm 95, but if you go back there, God says, that those people were so rebellious, I finally told them, as we understand, you know, as I read earlier, you're going to have to just go for 40 years in the wilderness and you're not going to enter the promised land. You know, your children will. All right, now we come to Numbers 20. And yet again, now this is of course later, but once again they're without water, and once again they're impatient about it. But remember, Moses did exactly as he was told the first time. He put the tree into the... wasn't it he had to put a tree in the water? And the next time he had to take a rod and smash the rock, and he did that. But this time he doesn't obey. Moses gets so angry that he doesn't obey that what God told him. He makes some dramatic move of his own. He loses control. Now, you can understand he was under a lot of pressure, but at the same time, he was an older man. He'd been through a lot too, and God had been working with him, and so he should have controlled himself. He was in front of everybody at the time. He was in front of the whole nation when he had this temper tantrum. Numbers 20. Now the children of Israel, the whole congregation, came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month, and the people stayed in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. We talked about that. Now there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and Aaron. You see, they didn't come to them to petition. They gathered against them. What a horrible thing. And the people contended with Moses and spoke, saying, if only we had died when our brethren died before the Eternal. What kind of thing is that to say? Why have you brought up the assembly of the Eternal into this wilderness that we and our animals should die here? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us to this evil place? Because you were slaves, because you were begging for help. What do you mean, why? You know, is it not a place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates. Well, that's because of you. If you had responded, you'd have been there. You have to wander around because of your attitude. It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink. So Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and they fell on their faces, and the glory of the Eternal appeared to them. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses, saying, "Take the rod, you and your brother Aaron, you know, once again, take that rod, and gather the congregation together, speak to the rock." Oh, he told him to speak to the rock because he wanted to focus this time more on him. You know, you pray, you speak to the rock will then, you know, gush forth. So it's not like you're doing anything, I'm doing it, but you're asking. You're saying something. And he said, "Speak to the rock before their eyes, and it will yield its water. Thus you shall bring water for them out of the rock and give drink to the congregation and their animals." And you know, this rock symbolized Christ. We understand that, 1 Corinthians 10. So Moses took the rod from before the Eternal as he commanded him, and Moses and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of this rock?" He just, you know, finally blew his top. Finally had enough. And it wasn't that he was worried about his own reputation. He was a humble man. He was just so angry with them and frustrated with them. And he lost it. Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock. Now, it's interesting. He had to do it twice. So I wonder if maybe the first time he struck it and nothing happened, he kind of began wondering if it was so wise to have started this. But then he went ahead and struck it again. Or maybe he just struck it twice out of anger, so angry that he hit it twice before he could realize he shouldn't have done it. Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. Now, it's interesting how God handled this. He did go ahead and honor what Moses did. He did not totally shame him and disgrace him in front of the congregation. The water did come out. But at the same time, privately, he then told him, you know, this was inappropriate. It's interesting how God handled it. He went ahead and honored Moses before the people, but then privately disciplined him. And later on, the people heard about it when their heads were cooler, when they could handle the information. Then Moses lifted his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. And Aaron is there again, and Aaron could have restrained him. Aaron could have said, "Wait, you're losing control. God said, speak to the rock." He could have held. No, don't hit it. Just talk to it. But Aaron didn't do anything. Aaron went along with it. And this was three strikes and you're out, as far as Aaron was concerned. You know, he was not going to enter the promised land. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses. And now, God says, to whom much is given, much is required. Moses had a great responsibility. He has great honor. We talk about the five books of Moses, the law of Moses. Moses is a great hero, into Jews, Muslims, Christians. All these movies are still made about him. You know, Moses did have a great responsibility. He was also accountable to maintain a standard. And here, in this case, he didn't. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel." You know, you could just speak to the rock. Don't worry, I'm powerful enough to make the water come. You don't have to hit the rock. What do you think, hitting it is going to give them all that water? You know, hitting it is no better than talking to it. I decide what you do. Then the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not believe me to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them." Thus was the water of Meribah, because the children of Israel contended with the Eternal, and he was hallowed among them. So here they call the water, he called it Meribah. The other was called Massah and Meribah, and this was just called Meribah, or strife. So we have Marah, the bitter place, then we have the testing and strife place, and then we have just the strife location, Meribah, in verse 13. So we have three different examples here, and in this third one, Moses didn't do what he was told, and because he didn't and lost his temper that way, in that public setting, in that very critical moment, you know, losing your temper at that critical moment, he was disciplined, and so he remained a leader, but he was not going to lead them into the promised land, nor was Aaron, nor was Aaron, as far as that's concerned. So let's now go to verse 23. Let's go back to verse 22. Oh, now we're in Numbers 20, verse 22. Now the children of Israel, the whole congregation, journeyed from Kadesh of Edom, saying, Aaron shall be gathered, and the Eternal spoke to... I'm sorry, I skipped. Let's go back to 22. Now the children of Israel, I got distracted. I heard this. Yes, I got distracted by the fact that I got a time signal. Now the children of Israel, the whole congregation, journeyed from Kadesh and came to Mount Hor. And the Eternal spoke to Moses and Aaron in Mount Hor by the border of the land of Edom, saying, Aaron shall be gathered to his people, for he shall not enter the land which I have given to the children of Israel, because you rebelled against my word at the water of Meribah. See, that was the third time Aaron had not acted appropriately. In the golden calf episode, in the episode with Miriam, and now in this episode. So he was going to die before they entered the land. He was Aaron's older brother, as you know. Then take Aaron and Eleazar his son and bring them up to Mount Hor, and strip Aaron of his garments and put them on Eleazar his son, for Aaron shall be gathered to his people and die there. So the priesthood was to continue. Aaron was not deprived of that. To this day, the descendants of Aaron are priests, and it passed on from Aaron and to his sons and so on. So Moses did just as the Eternal commanded, and they went up to Mount Hor in sight of all the congregation. Moses stripped Aaron of his garments and put them on Eleazar his son, and Aaron died there on the top of the mountain. Then Moses and Eleazar came down from the mountain. Now all the congregation saw that Aaron was dead. All the house of Israel mourned for Aaron 30 days. So they had, they mourned for Aaron as the priest. You know, he had a certain status as high priest of the nation, and so they mourned for him for 30 days. Now here in Numbers 21. After all this experience, again, we have the people rebelling and being stubborn. And at this point, they're right near the promised land. They're getting to the end of the 40 years. Come on, hang in there, you know, you want to say. Don't blow it now, because some of you can actually cross the Jordan. All right, your older people are going to die in the land, but you've lived a decent life. You've been cared for the whole time. But now the other people are going to actually enter the land, the younger ones. So don't blow it. But here we go. In verse 4 of chapter of Numbers 21, then they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way. All right, it's a long way to go, but you're coming to the end of the time. You know, the target is not that far off. And they got discouraged. Yeah, they had to go a roundabout way. That's true. They couldn't go more directly the way they wanted to go because the Edomites were hostile. So they had to go around the territory of Edom. Unfortunately, the Edomites had a wrong attitude. And the people spoke against God and against Moses. Could you imagine? Why don't they speak against the Edomites who had them, you know, who made them detour? And the people spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread. Oh boy, that's a very ungrateful thing to say. He'd been fed on manna, and manna was good. But after a while they got tired of it. You know, people get tired of even a good thing after a while. But even so, to call worthless food, this was manna from heaven. Worthless food, but that's what happens. And you know yourself that people, I have seen it myself in my own life. I've seen children who were very well-to-do from very wealthy homes, at least, you know, having temper tantrums, pitching a fit. You're not good parents, you're not, you know. And here they are so spoiled and, you know, doing so well. And all of us have seen examples like that. So you realize it is human nature to be that way. So the Eternal sent fiery serpents among the people. And to show that their attitude, that's what he, you know, in effect, he punished them. You know, the punishment fit the crime. You know, this is what they were like vipers. And so they were dealt with by vipers. So the Eternal sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and many of the people of Israel died. Therefore, the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Eternal and against you. Well, yeah, now they realize it, now that they're dying. Pray to the Eternal that he take away the serpents from us. So Moses prayed for the people. Then the Eternal said to Moses, make a fiery serpent. So he made a shiny serpent, a metallic serpent, and held it up, and it became a kind of symbol. You look at the serpent, and that would show them, in effect, you know, their sin. And so... In that case, they were protected. Then the Eternal said to Moses, make a fiery serpent and set it on a pole, and it shall be that everyone who is bitten, when he looks at it, shall live. So Moses made a bronze serpent and put it on a pole, and so it was, if a serpent had bitten anyone, when he looked at the bronze serpent, he lived. So they were healed by looking at that bronze serpent. They were healed. Now this serpent was a type of Christ. The New Testament tells us Christ became sin for us. So for a time he took upon himself all of the sins of the world, and he became sin for us. And he was up there on the executioner's stake, you know, and he died there. And he was there for a time on the stake, dead, you know, in ignominy for us. All of us deserve that, but he went through it for us. And in John 3, we're told that this serpent in the wilderness was a type of that. In John, the third chapter. John 3, verse 14. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. So you see, that serpent in the wilderness was a type. Christ took upon him the sins of the world, and he was lifted up on the execution stake there, and you know, died on the cross, crucified. And whoever believes in him should not perish but have eternal life. You know, this is John 3. So we have all of this background, and in conclusion, of course, Moses himself, as you know, also dies, not having entered the promised land. Of course, he was a great man, and the Bible acknowledges that. If you go to where he dies, go to Deuteronomy 34. I don't know if he had to write this about himself. It was more than likely written later. In fact, it might have been written much later. It might have been added by Ezra at the time the Bible was completed. The Old Testament was completed and canonized at the time of Ezra is likely when this passage was written. Here in Deuteronomy 34. Okay. So now Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the children of Israel heeded him as did as the Eternal had commanded Moses. Well, they had learned their lesson, and that's good. But since then, there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Eternal knew face to face. So throughout the rest of the Old Testament period, nobody came that equaled Moses. And yet Moses could not enter the promised land, you know, because towards the end of his life, he made a major mistake that was so costly, spiritually speaking, that God had to prevent him from entering the promised land. He died on the other side. He got to see it, as you know, but not to enter it. In all the signs and wonders which the Eternal sent him to do in the land of Egypt before Pharaoh, before all his servants and in all his land, and by all that mighty power and all the great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. A great man, the greatest of that era, you know, over all those centuries, the greatest over all those centuries, but yet restrained from entering the promised land. I'd like to now go to Hebrews 3, or Hebrews 4 rather. Hebrews 3 begins the discussion, but I can't really go there. Because otherwise the timekeeper is going to just run out of signs. It's going to go so long. So let's go to Hebrews, the fourth chapter. And in Psalm 95, I already talked to you. The first Bible study I ever attended in Big Sandy, they were talking about Hebrews 4. And I turned to Psalm 95 because that gave the background to Hebrews 4. And my date was all impressed. Wow, you knew to turn to Hebrews, to Psalm 95. I should have told her, just look in the margin of your Bible. It says Psalm 95. I'm not that brilliant. You know, but anyway, let's go to Hebrews 4, and we see that we have a situation such as the Israelites had. You know, we have seen God work in our lives. We understand what God has in store for us, but we have got to remain committed. We've got to continue on this path. We can't just, as we get older, finally decide, oh, I've had enough of this, you know, let's try something different. You know, no, and it should get better and better as we go along. We should appreciate it more and more as we go along. And so in Hebrews, the fourth chapter, he talks about Psalm 95, and he says that God says, don't follow that bad example of the Israelites because you want to inherit the promised land. You don't want to blow it. In verse 8 of Hebrews 4, you know, for if Joshua had given them rest, then he would not afterward have spoken of another day. See, the Psalm 95 talks about another day of rest, you know, that is yet ahead. So the entrance into the promised land was a type of that final rest, which is the true promised land, which is, of course, the millennium, which is eternal life for the saints. And that's what we're heading for. And we have to keep on that path. We have to stay committed to it and continue on it, even though we're getting on in years now. We've done this a long time. We have to do it longer. And he says in verse 9 of Hebrews 4, there remains therefore, you know, sabbatismos, there remains a keeping of the Sabbath for the people of God. And it goes beyond the fact that, yes, we keep the Sabbath from week to week. What remains for us is the antitype, the Sabbath, which is that period of time, that millennium of rest for the world. And far as that's concerned, it goes beyond that to an eternity of being spirit, not being physical, which is an eternity of rest from all the concerns of being physical. That remains, that wonderful reward remains for the people of God, committed Christian commandment keepers, continuing into that eternity that is awaiting us. Well, I hope you continue to listen right on through this talk, or if those of you who heard it, who will hear it another time, I'm grateful that you took the trouble to listen to it at a later time. Now, during the Festival of Tabernacles, we are going to have services some of the time at 3, as we do now. On the high days, probably the 1st and the 8th, we will have services at 3, and also on the weekly Sabbath. The rest of the time, we'll have them mostly in the morning at 10 o'clock our time, so it will be 7 a.m. on the West Coast. We will have a Friday night Bible study, which will be probably 8 o'clock our time, 5 p.m. on the West Coast, but we will post those on the website. Now, for the coming Day of Atonement, we will have services at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. So those of you on the West Coast, if you want to listen to us live, we'll be at noon. So enjoy the rest of the Sabbath. Have a wonderful Day of Atonement and a wonderful Festival of Tabernacles on the 8th day. All the best to you and yours.